Hello, my name's Guy Somerset. I'm the Books and Culture Editor of the New Zealand Listener, and this is the latest of our book club podcasts. This month we're discussing Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies, her sequel to Woof Hall, set amid the intrigue of Tudor Britain, specifically surrounding Thomas Cromwell and his role as Henry VIII's chief fixer. It struck me that it was a good book for us to be doing this week, in the week of the Diamond Jubilee over in Britain, although I can't help but think that a few heads on pikes might have enlivened celebrations over there, but alas, it wasn't to be. Now, I have a confession up front. I haven't done my homework, and I haven't read Woof Hall. It didn't feel, however, I have to say, less of a book for that, and I was quite keen to see how it would fare, because we obviously don't expect all of you to have gone out and read Woof Hall before reading Bring Up the Bodies. A fair few of you will have, however. Amongst our podcasters today, I'm going to find out who has and hasn't read Woof Hall. We have with us today Rochelle Handley of Pages Book Gallery in Whanganui, Todd Atticus of Unity Books in Wellington, and Avina Nikolic of Time Out Books in Auckland. So, you three, who has and who hasn't read Woof Hall?
I'll put my hand up and say this is Rochelle from Pages. I haven't read Woof Hall, but now having read Bring Up the Bodies, I will definitely go back and read Woof Hall because I've enjoyed it. But I don't think it's... I haven't been disadvantaged by not reading Woof Hall.
You didn't find yourself confused at the beginning at all about what was happening?
No, and I think Hilary Mantel does a really good job of the characterisation at the beginning. So you can, even though there's lots of characters in the book to get to know, you can refer back to the front and she sort of lists all the characters and where they fit in. And I think that definitely helped me throughout the book because I was always reverting back to see who was who. And yeah, but I didn't feel disadvantaged at all and was able to get straight into the story.
And Todd and Davina, have you both read Woof Hall?
Yes, I have actually. Hi, it's Nevena here from Time Out. Yes, I have read Woof Hall, and yes, I have to agree with Rochelle that I don't think it's necessary. She does a brilliant job of dropping you into the action and also setting up what's gone on before. But having said that, if you have read Woof Hall, I think it makes the experience of reading Bring Up the Bodies a lot richer, just in terms of understanding the characters, but yeah, I don't think it's entirely necessary.
How long ago was it that you read Woof Hall?
Well, I read Woof Hall when it won the Booker, so I think that was back in 2009. So it has been 3 years, I'd say, since I read it. But it was so vivid in my mind at the time that I found it all just came back to me reading Bring Up the Bodies, and it wasn't... I just felt like I was dropped back in the action. So it was really... it's one of those trilogies, I think, that it will be a trilogy, I understand, it will turn into a third book. I think it is much richer if you do try and read all three.
How about you, Todd? How long ago was it that you read Woof Hall?
Just a matter of days.
Well, it would be very fresh in your mind.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been... Woof Hall is a book that I've been wanting to read for ages. One of those on the perennial ones on the stack that always get demoted if on the release of something new. But I just felt compelled to read it before Bring Up the Bodies. I guess for that kind of sequential completeness. And I'm quite pleased that I did, although I actually agree completely with what Navina says with regards to it not being completely necessary how... Bring Up the Bodies is nicely self-contained. It does flesh out the experience for me somewhat in that Woof Hall provided, I guess, now I can look back and see across the two books, it provided me something to cling on to with regards to maybe the origins of why maybe a character, Risley, is called Call Me Risley. All these kind of sweet kind of side stories which... don't get a look in again in Bring Up the Bodies, but do kind of flesh out the history more in Woof Hall.
And how was it reading them both back to back? That's a sizable that's a sizable amount of reading. How was it being with these people for that length of time?
Actually, it was strangely compartmentalised. It was I think Bring Up the Bodies is a sleeker work. I think it actually does what it does in a more kind of erudite and direct way. So actually, although Woof Hall itself is absolutely fantastic. For me, there was a moment where I jumped forward to Bring Up the Bodies and was more compelled, and I worked through that with more pace and vigour than the one before. So actually, although it is one long story in itself, I actually felt a distinct remove from going from one, jumping from one to the other.
And conversely, you, Naveena, having read Wolf Hall back when it was originally published, were you holding out for a sequel? Was it a book that you really felt the urge to, follow up on?
Absolutely. When the rep showed us or gave us the reading copy and showed us that the new one was coming out, I was so excited. I must say, I was probably the most excited in the store because I was the only staff member that had read Wolf Hall. But yes, I'm, and I absolutely cannot wait for the third, which I hear she's writing. So
yes,
I'm interested to ask the two of you that have read it, if I'm allowed to ask now,
yes,
around Thomas Cromwell, the main character. We know in Wolf Hall, is he likable, or does he change between Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies?
I felt he changes. I felt, although he's a pretty abominable character in both, if you kind of take his actions at face value. There are far more scenes where his crackling evilness comes to the fore in Bring Up the Bodies. I think it's definitely more subtly underplayed in Wolf Hall, and
right,
because he's moving towards assuming his mantle beside the king. It's obviously quite a journey for him, but now Bring Up the Bodies, you start page one and he's at his full prowess or his power, and he definitely. I felt there were some scenes in Bring Up the Bodies where I came up with a kind of a much more sour taste of the man than I did in Wolf Hall.
Is he so evil?
I'm not sure.
I mean, is he not a kind of pragmatist in that period?
I found him a likable character. And at times I felt extremely sorry for him because, you know, he damned if he did and damned if he didn't in a way. So. You know, it's definitely a story where everybody's out watching their back, and, you know, it shows the bringing down of Anne Boleyn, exactly that. Many times throughout the story I felt for him because it wasn't always what he wanted to do, but it was survival.
Yeah. I want to come back to that theme a little bit later, if we could, because I'm interested in the whole theme of power, really, as it is in the book. But perhaps just quickly, I'm quite intrigued to know what it was like reading the book as New Zealanders. I'm English. We have the story of Henry VIII thrust down our throats from a very early age, and I was brought up in the near Kimbolton and Peterborough, so even more so for me. But I was intrigued to know how much of this history you actually knew as readers before coming to the book. Did you all know pretty much the outline of what was going to happen?
Yes, I think the Tudors in particular are just so much stuff of myth and legend, and I don't know how old everybody else is, but certainly English history was more was covered more in school than our own Maori and colonial history, and I feel there's a lot in popular culture, for instance the television show of the Tudors and Philippa Gregory's books and the movie, I think, with Scarlett Johansson, so there is a sort of general knowledge out there, even if you don't have a personal knowledge. So it is the stuff of myth and legend for us.
And was that the same for you and Todd and Rochelle?
Yes, I definitely go along those lines. I was familiar with, Anne of Boleyn. Growing up, I remember, the Three Musketeers, and so I was very familiar with, that part of history. So.
And Todd?
As much the same as you guys, I'm going to impart my secret. I'm English as well, and my actual experiences of learning Tudor history at school, at primary school, was actually a very it was built around very kind of abstract points of the time. So it was we learned how to make quince jelly, and we constructed Tudor frame housing in Baltimore. So actually, I would have loved something like this. I think I would have engaged much more if I'd had.
I don't know. I think we should call you in and have you. I think this could be another sideline for the book. Some Baltimore would, I think, would be very good.
Yeah, I've been waiting for quince jelly to be mentioned. It wasn't in Wolf Hall, but they do make reference to Bring Up the Bodies. I thought, well, at least I know something.
In this respect, then, we all pretty much know where the novel's heading. the novel functions in an interesting way, doesn't it? Because it's not so dependent on the bigger plot as other novels might be. It's kind of what the flesh, as it were, that Mantell puts on that plot that really brings this novel alive. Would you agree?
I think that's fantastic how Hilary Mantel's done that. Just in the fact that going into the novel, everyone knows what's going to happen. and you can't interest the reader through the plot alone. So she's really good, like, in the first person and using Thomas Cromwell's character to sort of hook you in there and seeing everything as Thomas experiences it. And I really liked how she done that. It definitely kept you hooked in through the character rather than, you know, what's going to happen next.
And although we would know about the bigger plot, she either invents, imagines, or, re-records, as it were, from the historical record, details, encounters, conversations, characters that we wouldn't know about. And she does that, I think, absolutely marvellously. Would you agree, Navina?
Yes, she absolutely brings, she makes it completely plausible and brings out, and she puts in enough historical detail that you feel that you're there in the court, you see the costumes, you smell the smells, you're experiencing the weather, and I think she just does a brilliant job of dropping you into that period. She's definitely one of the best historical fiction writers out there, and the story is so character driven that it is all about the characters. You just care about the character, and it is all about Thomas, I think, and less so about Henry and Anne and all the other players in the court. So yes, she has a great ability in that way. Mm.
There are a lot of characters. As somebody mentioned before, I think it was you, Rochelle, having recourse to the character list at the front of the book. I must admit, I found myself needing that more and more as names would come back, and there'd be slight permutations on people's names as well, and you'd have to try and figure out who they were. There's a lot of characters in there. It's But as you say, Cromwell absolutely at the focus of it. But let's just talk a little bit about the other characters, the other main characters. Henry, for a start, what do we make of Henry as depicted in this novel, obviously through Cromwell's eyes? Todd, how did Cromwell play for you? Henry.
Henry, yeah. I'm fascinated by the scenes in which you see Henry, because, I mean, aside from the fact that I think the dialogue between Thomas and Henry, it crackles, it fizzes and pops. I love the fact that the character of Cromwell, as Mantell portrays him, doesn't pull his punches with regards to Henry. The character, I think, he comes across as actually, I think, far more human than I have in my mind from learning about him in history. He has, I mean, aside from the fact that he is incredibly fickle, I love the passages later in the novel when Thomas is mentally producing his book to teach others about Henry. I can't actually recall the name of the book that he's titled, but he has in his head a list of kind of Henry's attributes and ways to treat him. I think he imparts some of this onto his son when he's appointed to the Privy Chamber, or the Privy Council rather, that how to treat Henry.
that is great, isn't it?
And I think in those moments we're painted an absolutely fantastic portrait of the king.
And in terms of Henry, he's an interesting figure in many ways. I mean, one of the themes of the book, I said before, I thought, power, it's almost, you're in the kind of last king of Scotland territory in a way, the Idi Amin or any of contemporary dictators. I mean, you absolutely have to play Henry, and Cromwell obviously does. And Cromwell's survival is kind of dependent upon him doing some very terrible things, because if he doesn't do them to others, they'll do them to him. It's a very, very strong depiction of power that I think, as I say, I think still holds true in certain parts of the world today. Did anybody sort of share that sense, a sense of that theme?
Oh, absolutely. that intrigue at court was one of the really fascinating aspects of the book, and I think that's what makes Thomas so great, is that he doesn't have that aristocratic background, he doesn't have the pedigree, so to speak, but he has this huge intellect, and that enables him to keep sort of 10 steps ahead of everybody else. He holds all these facts about of people at court in his mind, and both good and bad, and it's this and also he gets the measure of Henry, and I think that is what keeps him at the fore and ahead of the axe, I think, in many ways. And it was beautifully played, actually, in Bring Up the Bodies, especially.
For the two of you who've read the Wolf Hall, one of the things that seemed about this novel was that aging. The aging of Cromwell and Henry is kind of brought to the fore, the sense that, you know, Henry isn't the slim young thing that he was. Cromwell isn't, you know, he's now 50. There's a sense that the characters are aging. Are they changing at all as they age from Wolf Hall?
They are playing their parts more. It's almost like they're becoming refinements of their character, I think. The fact that they're aging, I think, brings back this kind of... the quickness to the way that Henry and Thomas both act. I think they have their established routine set now, and the fact that the plot in this book, it only takes place throughout just one calendar year, I think really kind of shows the pace that these two men work at. I think they're probably aware of the aging process. Certainly they both acknowledge it many times in the book, but it brings about the events in a quicker manner, I think.
The other main character, obviously, is Anne Boleyn. What do you make of Anne Boleyn, Rochelle?
She intrigued me, and she had an amazing strength, and the demise of her, just how that played out. Once again, Hilary Mantel really doing great stuff around, you know, showing how she got brought down, and... not really standing a chance. Your heart goes out to that to her. And the thing that I couldn't believe is it happened so quickly. You know, the demise of her. I didn't actually realise that it all sort of turned around in about a month's time frame. And I hadn't realised that.
It's interesting. I mean, he's 50 now. I mean, he's famous for having six wives. He's going to be moving through them at quite a clip years to come.
Because I actually thought Henry was shown, in some respects, as quite a weak man, and it was Thomas that went through fixing everything. You know, he was the fixer for Henry. And, you know, he managed the whole execution of Anne Boleyn so he could marry Jane Seymour, and often Henry, you know, he was didn't want to go near London because of the plague, so he had all these fears, and I that came out quite strongly, where Thomas was, yeah, he was the strong character, and Henry always sort of, I liked how she showed him, he was kind of on the sidelines, so to speak.
I read a review, actually, that likened Thomas to Stalin's Beria. You know, Thomas was his sort of right-hand man that did all this dirty work, and I thought that was a really apt analogy.
Yeah, because you kind of see the king as ruling and him being the strong one, but definitely, Hilary Mantel doesn't portray it like that, does she?
The descriptive language, I think, in the book is just astonishingly good.
Oh, amazing.
And, you know, it feels very true to the time as well. I mean, it's very earthy, to say the least, at times. It's incredibly evocative. She really gives you a real sense of the period in every respect, from the violence to the social settings.
And yet it doesn't feel weighty at any point, I didn't think. It scaffolds itself nicely. It carries the reader. It provides... It plays in a deliciously pictorial way at times. It doesn't trip underneath its own weight. It carries forwards in a streamlined manner, I thought. And I mean, some of the words. Oh, can I just mention the word exsanguinates? Which I thought it's almost like the book is playing up until this one word for me. It just pops out, and I have to admit, hand on heart, I needed to look up the definition. It's not a word I use daily.
What does it mean?
It means to spill blood or to pass blood, and it's the word that's used at the execution. But it just popped out of the page at me, and I just thought, wow, that's such a glorious word to use, and it's...
hopefully you won't get many opportunities to
use it. Hopefully I don't, but I'm certainly waiting for my next opportunity to do so.
I did think, and... probably this isn't the case in Wolf Hall, but at the beginning I felt that it was a little bit close to the problem that a lot of historical novels had, which is I felt that I was getting a few history lessons rather than a naturally told narrative. She seemed to be telling me facts in order to sort of set me up for the novel. I don't know whether anybody else felt that, and it's reminded me a little bit of reading through the early Harry Potter books, where she feels obliged to fill you in about people from the previous novels, which she later stops doing. I did feel a little bit at the beginning I was being told a lot of things to set me up. Did anybody else kind of feel that weight there at the beginning in the first few chapters?
A little bit, having read Wolf Hall, I thought, but I thought she was doing the reader a service. You know, she was almost sort of saying, well, okay, you haven't read Wolf Hall, here's, let me bring you up to speed. So, but I must say, if you have read Wolf Hall, it was a little bit tedious because it was a little bit repetitive of what had gone on before. But yeah, so I guess it depends on whether you've read Wolf Hall or not, whether you find it annoying or not. But
and maybe that's the clever thing that she has done, because that cast of characters, she has set a scene. I didn't find it too tedious though, because it didn't go, you know, it didn't go on and on. It was, I quite liked it, and that's probably around not having read the first book.
One thing that also annoyed me, I'm sorry, I'm on the negatives now, because anybody who's followed this book club will know that the people who take part in it are very quick to find the negatives. Cromwell. You know, she insists on calling him he all the way through, and sometimes I wasn't quite sure who he was, and I wasn't quite sure whether she was using he, Cromwell, just to help me along there, or whether this was a more stylized thing.
This, for me, is an ironing out of something that I thought was a problem in Wolf Hall, and that is, on many occasions, you just get he without any attribution to who he means. And in this one, I think she's ironed it out more. Maybe someone's mentioned it into her ear after Wolf Hall, but actually I felt that it was a lot clearer in many... I mean, she still... There are many instances where he deems Cromwell, but she sometimes he, comma, Cromwell, which I was quite thankful for because it delineates it.
Reminded me a bit also. I, Claudius, I couldn't help wondering whether it's some kind of reference to that. Any other negatives for anybody else? Any things that you didn't like about it?
No, not for me. I think it's one of the most extraordinary historical works of fiction I've read in a long time. I think she's at the top of her game. So, no, I can't think of too many negatives. Yeah.
Well, I can't either. I'm not a historical fiction reader, generally, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've got no negatives at all.
I'm entirely beguiled by it. I can't even think of anything that I would fault it on, which is probably one of the worries I had coming into this podcast, and I thought, oh, I don't have a negative at all, but it's captivating and enrapturing, and it's storytelling in the grandest tradition, I think.
And storytelling you kind of want to luxuriate in. I have to read a lot of books and have to read them really quickly. This isn't a book I wanted to read quickly. I wanted to kind of come home to it at night on a cold winter's night and really get it. Settle down with it. It strikes me as a book that really isn't there to be rushed.
No, you need to take your time with it. You need to give the language its due, I think. And it's really a reader's book. You need to find yourself an armchair and let it overtake you, I think. It's not one for 10 minutes on a bus in between stops or anything at all.
Yeah, you're in there experiencing that world, aren't you? So
yeah,
you need to give it that time.
And are we all, I think we probably all are, all now ready for part three?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And having said at the beginning I haven't done my homework reading Wolf Hall, I've not done my homework, and Thomas Cromwell isn't a figure that really did crop up in school history very much. So do people know what's going to happen to him, or is it going to be as much of a mystery to you as me? I mean, obviously he's going to die at some point, but, you know, I don't know how and when or why. Does anybody else?
No, I suspect he will meet his downfall eventually, but whether it's natural or via an axe, I'm not sure. I don't actually know.
Would you like it to be via an axe? Do you think he deserves to go via an axe?
No, I think he is. No, I think he's strong enough to die of a a blissful old age and retire with Henry, perhaps. I'm not sure.
I think he knows that it's going to be otherwise, though, by the end. Do you not get the sense that he feels the shadows creeping along the walls slightly?
He does. I do think he feels those shadows creeping up, and he is really conscious of it. But I do think that his intellect is such that he will keep 10 steps ahead.
That's true.
Well, we will find out, but probably not for a couple of years, which is very frustrating, I know. Thank you very much, Rochelle, Todd and Navina, and thanks very much for listening to this, our latest Book Club podcast. We'll be back next month when we're going to be talking about three books, the finalists in the New Zealand Post Book Awards. So quite a lot to fit in. Until then, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.